Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Carrie Young, in for Tiziana Deering. The future of Boston Public Schools is at a critical juncture. A last-minute deal was reached last night with state education leaders on a systemic improvement plan. That means BPS is avoiding state intervention for now. And if that's not enough, after 3 months, we're just one day away from the vote for a new superintendent. Boston Public Schools seems to be going through a cycle of leaders and interim leaders coming through every few years. The most recent is Superintendent Brenda Caselius, who is stepping down after just 3 years in the position. The superintendent race began with 34 candidates, and today two remain. Mary Skipper is one of them. She's currently superintendent of Somerville Public Schools. And also we have Tommy Welch, who is currently working as BPS's Region 1 school superintendent. Here to break all of that down with us is Max Larkin, education reporter for WBUR. Welcome, Max.
Hi, Carrie.
So, Max, I know you have a really busy day and even really busy week, but right now you're monitoring the June meeting of the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education. And I hear that so far there's been a lot of talk about this new systemic improvement plan with BPS. So can you tell us a little bit more first about what exactly that is?
Yeah, it's basically a plan about how to improve quickly in seven key areas of what the school district does, Carrie, from special education and English learners, school buses, facilities repairs, sort of core functions. And it commits Boston to making those improvements, sometimes on a pretty tight timeline. They've got some stuff they've got to get done by mid-August this year, for example. And yet, Carrie, it is an agreement and not a top-down imposition from state officials. And that's a function of these 11th-hour negotiations between Boston Mayor Michelle Wu and district officials on one side and the Office of State Education Commissioner Jeff Riley. So earlier this morning, Riley said when he became commissioner a few years back, his office, which you and I called DESE, used to be all about compliance all the time. And he saw this agreement as a chance to demonstrate a shift.
But we also need to be a supportive organization. And I think during the time of COVID, we've been able to start pivoting more to be a supportive agency. And we want to continue that both statewide and with this Boston Public School Systemic Improvement Plan.
So after Riley said that, Carrie, you had several board members, Darlene Lombos, Amanda Fernandez, kind of applauding that new face for DESE, implying that they were never happy with the kind of or else approach that DESE had been taking with Boston up to and ending last night.
Well, can you break down a little bit more how we got to this systemic improvement plan? There were, you know, discussions before this about how much of a role the state should play in the district.
Yeah, I have to ignore the elephant in the room, Carrie, that you are an education reporter as well and know in part this story. But yeah, just as schools closed for the pandemic 2 years ago, Boston got this pretty damning report from the state that said it had to improve in all these areas. It was awkward timing, but after 2 years elapsed, the state found again that Boston had made some progress, but not enough. And so they released a kind of successor report and put Boston on track to what some feared would be full state takeover. Then the two sides enter into negotiations and they craft this, to my mind, quite ambitious agreement, but one that staves off that threat, which would have meant a lot of work for DESE and a kind of loss of local control in Boston.
Okay, so this improvement plan does kind of get us to a point where, you know, we're going to see what happens. But is receivership or state intervention off the table for BPS?
I think certainly it became less likely with this deal, which has a term of 3 years, but it's definitely not off the table. You can observe a footnote in the script in the agreement says nothing in this agreement limits the statutory authority of DESE. So if we don't like what we're seeing, all of those options come back on the table. And in fact, you had one of the more historically sort of hawkish receivership friendly members of the board, Michael Moriarty, say He was displeased by the deal because it looked like Boston had kept too much of its freedom with too little commitment to change. He said to Riley, at the first sign of intransigence, put receivership back on the table. So there are going to be members of that board who are saying they're not moving fast enough. Let's be a little harder on them.
So I guess for me and you, Max, that means to stay tuned, huh?
Indeed, it does.
Now, we did get a statement from BPS last night, and it says that, quote, the plan includes clear timelines and joint commitments to eliminate systemic barriers to education opportunity, build the operational capacity to implement systemic change, and support Boston students in achieving their full potential. Now, Max, is there any indication on what those timelines are more specifically, and maybe what some of those other commitments might look like right now? And also, can you talk about accountability measures that this plan has?
Yeah, so on that latter half of the question, Wu and the city of Boston and the district will be making regular reports about their commitments that they've made and how they're living up to them. The first report is slated to happen before the end of August, so before the school year begins again, and they'll be in regular contact on a monthly basis with DESE officials or maybe Riley personally to see how things are going. In terms of concrete deadlines, they have to hire a data auditor, DESE does, to look at Boston's data, which has been faulted as unreliable by mid-August, as I said. They also are committed to hiring a team of people who are going to revamp special education offerings in the district by mid-August. They're also going to come up with a new system to respond to reports of bullying or violence in the schools by mid-August. So there's quite a lot to be done in what are normally sleepy summer months.
I know, just listening to that list, you can just hear the magnitude of everything that's included.
Yeah, it is a dizzying amount of work that's going to have to get done in Nubian Square.
Well, it's not just the BESE meeting that's happening this week for BPS. The Boston School Committee will be meeting on Wednesday to vote on who will be the next district superintendent. How does this BESE meeting impact that, or does it at all?
I spoke to Paul Revel, who had been the chairman of the state board and also the state's education secretary, and he was concerned, as I think many were, that a decision to downgrade Boston as an underperforming school felt like a way of upstaging or kind of lame ducking the next superintendent. Like, yeah, you've got a new leader, but the state's here as well, and that's going to be more impactful. So I think the fact that they reach agreement means whoever is selected tomorrow night will have a little bit more freedom of movement, though, of course, they will also be immediately thrown into meeting all these ambitious deadlines that we talked about.
Okay, Max, stay with us. Right now, we do want to bring in another voice to this conversation on the superintendent search. Joining us now to talk about that is, and the challenges involved with the search and just facing the whoever takes this job is Glenn Kuchar, the executive director of the Massachusetts Association of School Committees. Welcome, Glenn.
Hi, thank you very much.
Okay, so we're down to just two candidates for the superintendent in Boston after we mentioned there were dozens of people that threw their hat in the ring for this job. Can you set the scene a little bit for us, though, and tell us how this superintendent search process typically works for any district? I know your organization works a lot in this space, right?
Yeah, we do. We help a lot of districts looking for superintendents. And there is a formal process. Most districts follow it. Boston certainly went through a pretty rigorous process of recruitment, maintaining the confidentiality of the names of the candidates in order to protect them. As you go through this and being exposed to the public. And the pool of candidates is not as big as it used to be in the past, so there are challenges that go into all of the searching process. However, Boston got off to a very good start. They had a lot of applicants. They had a very diligent and diverse and well-thinking search committee. They worked expeditiously. I think it was a model process in terms of the process itself. What nobody can control is when it comes time to push the button and say, yes, I am willing to have my name going forward and be a finalist in public, that's when you see candidates making a second-guess decision and withdrawing. It's not unusual. It's happened almost everywhere where a superintendent search takes place. It's got very little to do with the process. It has to do with the individual candidates. But I will say this. I know of both finalists. I know one of them a little better than the other. But I will tell you, based on what we know about the candidates and the finalists, Boston will be lucky to have either one of them taking this position. They're both people with distinguished records. They are intelligent, articulate, good communicators, and they've paid their dues and done the hard work up to now, although not necessarily always in Boston, but partially in Boston and partially elsewhere. So I would be very optimistic in terms of the school committee's ability to make a good choice and to move forward. I agree with what your colleague has just said. The new superintendent coming in is going to have an opportunity as the new person to be given some space, but also the opportunity to work on an entry plan that's been developed in collaboration with the state.
Well, Glenn, so I want to jump in here and ask you something related to that, too.
Sure.
The opportunity to make change and work with the district. You know, I want to talk a little bit about tenure and how long superintendents stay to actually do some of the things that they're tasked with, goals that they have. In my 4.5 years here in Boston, I've seen 3 people lead BPS. There was Tommy Chang, then there was interim superintendent Laura Peril, and then outgoing superintendent Brenda Caselius. How normal is it, looking statewide, to have superintendents cycle in and out? Like, is 3 years or so kind of normal, or is that a little short?
Well, the average lifespan of a superintendent in the office is about 4.5 years, but that's largely because of the state's early retirement system. Most superintendents are not terminated or contracts non-renewed, they retire. But what I think is different about this situation is now you've got 2 people who are veterans of the Boston experience. And while you don't ever want to say, these people know the system, these people will jump right in, that's not really a legitimate concern. But what is of value is that they are going to come in with the depth of knowledge, not only of the nature of the work in general, but of an understanding of the city of Boston and the school issues and some familiarity with, certainly with familiarity with how a school committee operates and some familiarity with how to work with a mayor.
Well, it does seem like both of these candidates do have experience with BPS, a pretty lengthy experience.
Yes.
Mary Skipper,
yes.
She's currently the superintendent of Somerville Public Schools, but she has worked with BPS quite extensively in the past.
Yep.
There's also, as we mentioned, Tommy Welch, who is currently working with BPS as the Region 1 school superintendent.
Correct.
And quickly, Glenn, I want to ask you, you know, and we've touched on this a little bit before in this interview, that the Boston School Committee has come under fire by the NAACP for lack of representation with these 2 finalists. Neither of these candidates are Black or Latino, even though the majority of the school population is. So can you speak to the importance of representation in such a high-profile position like this?
Well, it's very important that faculty members and students see people who look like they do when they're trying to do their work or to learn in classrooms or to lead a school. Occasionally, the process throws you curves. And in this case, the withdrawal of a couple of candidates made that a little more difficult with regard to producing specifically diverse cohort candidates for the superintendency. I can't pretend not to understand the frustration with the NAACP or the Spanish-speaking community that they don't necessarily see someone from their community being nominated for the superintendency. It's a risk that comes with any search process. It has nothing to do with the diligent work of the search committee or the work of the school committee to run a program with integrity. And sometimes this is just what happens. Now, there are a lot of ways to address this. And among the ways to address this is to make the most effective use of a diverse staff in the central office, diversity in the school principalships, diversity in the department heads, and a strong effort to create equality and diversity and inclusion for students. That said, there's no way to get around the frustration. Everybody wants to see someone from their cohort making the final round, and regrettably, two candidates who were to have been finalists did withdraw. And I can tell you, there are a lot of reasons that people withdraw. And I can't speak for anybody in Boston because I don't even know who the other two candidates were. But I can say that anyone looking at the situation might say, wow, this is a real challenge. I might be coming to Boston without any friends in the community, without anyone to have my back if there's a crisis. There are two finalists who are really distinguished people with a history of internal work in Boston. I'm thinking I've got a 1 in 4 chance of getting this job, and I don't want to be known as the person who wasn't hired in Boston.
I mean, that sounds understandable.
When people withdraw.
Glenn, it's a complicated process, and I appreciate you weighing in on this. We have to leave it there. That was Glenn Kuchar, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Association of School Committees. Thanks for joining us, Glenn.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
So with the few seconds we have left, I do want to turn it back to WBUR's education reporter, Max Larkin. And Max, quickly, looking ahead to the school committee vote tomorrow, what have you been hearing about the two candidates? Are there any thoughts going around about frontrunner? Is everyone kind of silent?
I don't think anybody is in the business of picking a frontrunner. Certainly Mary Skipper has this long track record and has done the job, but people think very, very highly of Tommy Welch as well. So I wouldn't want to be handicapping it myself.
Thanks, Max. That was Max Larkin, education reporter for WBUR. Max, thank you for joining us in your busy schedule today.
Thanks for having me, Carrie.